Thank you all so much for being here today. I want to welcome you to Reading Like a Writer Perspective. My name is Dawn Tripp, and I'm thrilled to be hosting this session today, Reading Like a Writer Perspective, featuring authors Rachel Kadish, Brendan Matthews, and Paul Yoon. This session is a unique alternative to a traditional reading and will consist of 20-minute explorations of each author's work. I've read all three books, and they're exceptional works of fiction, each very different in terms of theme, setting, character, and story. Each has its own stunningly original voice and perspective, and I love works that have a real sense of life on the page, and all three of these books do. Our first author today is Rachel Kadish, who will be discussing her extraordinary new novel, The Weight of Ink, a literary mystery of intellectual passion, scholarship, and intrigue that moves back and forth between 17th century London and the early 21st century. The novel opens when an aging British history professor, Helen, is called on by a former student to view Jewish documents from the 1600s discovered in the staircase of an old house under renovation. With an eager young American graduate student, Helen embarks on a quest to determine the identity of the document's scribe. A sweeping, erudite novel for readers of A.S. Byatt's Possession and Tom Stoppard's Arcadia, The Weight of Ink is at once epic and intimate, a riveting, nuanced novel about two women separated by four centuries who share a faith in the power of the mind. Toni Morrison calls Rachel Kadish a gifted writer, astonishingly adept at nuance, narration, and the politics of passion. I thought that was really great. The Weight of Ink has received stellar reviews from The New Republic, Lit Hub, Jewish World News, among others. Radio Boston calls the novel an amazing feat, a great literary and intellectual mystery. Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein writes, "The Weight of Ink tells of the struggle and triumph of a woman trying to do justice to the largeness of her intellect and ambition. As audacious in its conception as it is brilliant in its execution." And a starred review in Booklist writes, "Kadish positions two women born centuries apart, yet united by a thirst for knowledge, at the core of a richly textured, addictive novel, stretching back and forth through time, from contemporary London to the late 17th century. Kadish has fashioned a suspenseful literary tale that serves as a compelling tribute to women across the centuries, committed to living, breathing, and celebrating the life of the mind." So, Rachel, let's move to the passage you chose. I've asked each writer to choose a passage they felt had some deep link to the overall scope or theme of the story, a passage that in some way they felt inspired to discuss in relationship to perspective. Will you read it aloud?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. And thanks, everybody, for coming. June 8th, 1691, 11 Sivan of the Hebrew year 5451. Richmond, Surrey. Let me begin afresh, perhaps this time to tell the truth. For in the biting hush of ink on paper, where truth ought raise its head and speak without fear, I have long lied. I have not to defend my actions, yet though my heart feels no remorse, my deeds would confess themselves to paper now as the least of tributes to him whom I once betrayed. In this silenced house, quill and ink do not resist the press of my hand, and paper does not flinch. Let these pages compass at last the truth, though none read them.
So I would love you to talk just a little bit about this passage and how it came to you. When we were emailing back and forth, you said that for you this the voice of this passage and this prologue really was your way in to the story.
Thanks. Yeah, this was the first thing I wrote, which miraculously survived the whole writing, editing, and cutting process. What happened for me is that I tend to start writing when something is bothering me and I can't quite figure out why, and I can't articulate it until I write something with it or about it. And one of the things I was thinking about years back was that question that was most famously posed by Virginia Woolf: what if William Shakespeare had had an equally talented sister? What would have been the fate of a woman like that? And Woolf's answer is very succinct. She died young. She never wrote a word. And that is the most likely fate for a woman of that time period. But of course, I couldn't help asking, you know, what if, what would it take for a woman with that kind of capacious intelligence of that time not to die without writing a word? And of course, it's not just an academic question. We all know people, now that because of the circumstances of their birth or their race or ethnicity or gender are not able to do what they have in them. So I kept thinking, I wanted to write something that reached back in time to ask that question, what would it take for a woman not to die without writing a word, you know, when everything around her is telling her to sit down and mind her manners. So I wanted to write a historical novel. I wanted that feeling, that really rich feeling you can get from a historical novel. And I went looking for a time period, and I was totally captivated by what I started reading about this tiny community in the 17th century of Portuguese Inquisition Jewish refugees. And they're in the 17th century in Amsterdam, and some of them are in London, but I think what got to me about them was the more I read about them, I mean, you could hear their fear and this beautiful determination to rebuild after all they'd been through. And I grew up around Holocaust survivors because that was my mother's family. My mother was a refugee kid born on the run. And I was just like, these are refugees. They may be in the 17th century, but I know these people. And so I was hooked in, and I wanted to write about a woman in a community like this who persists. And of course, she would have had to be a genius at breaking rules, because you can't be a, you know, quote, nice girl and not be silenced when the rules of the society say you have to be silent. So I started writing this voice. I had no idea what, it was a woman, she was confessing something. And in order to have her own voice, she had had to make certain sacrifices and break certain rules. And I just started writing with no idea what any of it meant. And then I went from there.
Did you have was the language, was this pretty intact when it came out? Did it change? And I'm curious about one image in The Biting Hush of ink on paper, because we think sometimes of writing as an act that takes place in solitude, and an act that you know, does take place in that quiet, you know, in self and in our surroundings. But it also has you know, that potential to be violent or revolutionary.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to capture something about the power of writing. And also, literally, in this day and age, to write certain things, it was life or death. This was a time period when people were, you know, not metaphorically, but literally ripped limb from limb for discussing atheism. So I wanted the power and the danger, the fear of those words on paper, and also just as a writer, as a lover of the written word, you know, to remember that power. I know, you know, we're all in an age of Twitter. It matters, and it changes lives. And I also went and I learned how to write with a quill pen, because I needed to find out what sound it made. It's like the sound of it, like an animal scratching inside a wall or something like that, that quill sound. And I wanted to evoke that and the power of it. The language, I struggled a long time with the language, although this came out pretty much intact. But as I went on, I had to really find a way to write 17th century language in a way that would be accessible. And at first, I was completely hamstrung by this idea that I needed to just be authentic, accurate. So I had to write the way Samuel Pepys wrote and Richard Burton and The Anatomy of Melancholy. I needed those kind of sentences. But nobody, there's a reason that people don't read Samuel Pepys' diary just for fun. And it's completely salacious stuff. I mean, we should, right? But we don't, because that language is hard to access. But I was hung up on it till I read this wonderful interview by David Mitchell, where he talked about coming up with a language for a historical novel, and he referred to inventing something he referred to as bygoneese, which meant that it had to be a plausibly old-sounding language. You couldn't be anachronistic, but you also couldn't write literally the way they spoke then, because it's not accessible. And that liberated me, because what I found was the vocabulary was amazing. I love the richness of those words. Let these pages compass the truth. Compass used as a verb. I mean, I could just sit and look at that all day. I love that stuff. But the sentence structure they used in the 17th century was like serpentine, loop-de-loop, you know, having gone to this place, I saw this thing, which having known blah, 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 and you get all the way to the end of the sentence and you just, you know. And I just didn't want to write that way. So what I chose to do in the end was, my rule for myself was that I could use a more modern, simple sentence structure. And even in this opening, the sentences are really, you know, perhaps this time to tell the truth, almost fragments, because I wanted to have it in small, compact pieces, and to be able to really walk in and have these short, blunt sentences. But every word I use, if I did this right, was in use in the 17th century. And I was enough of a nerd that if I wasn't sure about a word, Merriam-Webster first known use tells you for every single word in the dictionary when is the first known use of it, and if it wasn't used till 1705, I didn't use it. So if when Esther later on in the book is accompanying Mary around town, I don't use the word chaperone. She's her companion or duenna, because chaperone is a 1700s word.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
And how did this passage for you in your process launch you into a novel that's also a conversation between Esther's time period and Helen's time period?
Right. I think it's always felt very natural to me, maybe because of some of what I grew up with my family, that there's this history floating around, and every now and then it just clobbers you in the head. You're not expecting it, and someone will make a reference to, you know, in my case, in my family, well, you know, yeah, but that's when we were in the Russian prison, past the water, you know, and just, and so it's very natural to me, this idea that history would sort of float up in moments when we're not expecting it, and then we're faced with a choice. Do we ignore it and ignore what it's telling us about today, or do we explore it? So I think I wanted to start with this voice. Like, here it is. As the reader, you open the book, and this is the first thing you experience. You're in this life, this moment of, like, someone's confessing something and is racked with guilt about it, but she would do it all the same anyway. And then we're in the present day, and how do these things speak to each other? Because I think a lot of these issues carry through for women's voices and what it means to can you still belong to a community if what you really feel and believe is forbidden by that community?
And one of the things that I love is that the movement, sometimes in novels that move back and forth in time between present and past, they're not necessarily advancing. Do you know what I mean? One section is not advancing. And I love the way that the shifts are actually advancing the sense of story. Is that something you were cognizant of as you were working?
Thank you.
Or is that something you went back to kind of...
Oh, my God. By the seat of my pants, I had no... Okay, so I don't know how musicians or artists improvise. That is totally beyond me. My brother plays jazz saxophone. Like, how do you do that? You know, I have no idea. But when I write, I improvise. And so I wrote this in the order it's in. I would be writing, and Helen and Aaron, the contemporary scholars, would be reading a document, and there's a phrase of Latin written in the margins. So, you know, they're like, huh, what's that about? I don't know. Let's go back to the 17th century and see why she would have written that in the margins. And then I go there, and I write that for a while, and then I think, okay, well, what will Helen and Aaron interpret this right when they see it? And I'd go back. So it was totally, so I was discovering as I went.
Right. So the closing line of this passage, let these pages compass at last the truth, though none read them. You know, this question of truth, of uncovering the truth, the historical truth, is a driving component of this story. And we sometimes think of truth as being solid. You know, as the historical record is kind of being this solid thing. But, you know, the historical record is kaleidoscopic, and it's continually changing. It's an interpretation, and it's continually changing according to our perspective. And a really fascinating review of your book in The New Republic wrote, "The past is not a conclusive backstory to our lives, but a powerful resource that opens out into every narrative, every fiction, every self." And when I read that, I was really thinking about the plausibility of a woman having written this way. And I was just wondering in your research if you could talk a little bit about that, how your discovery of that plausibility in your research.
Yes. Oh, thanks for asking about that. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the past, you think about for any of our lives, 200 years from now, if someone were researching your life, what would you have left behind, and how much of who you actually are and what you actually think and feel would they be able to uncover? I mean, the historical record only shows bits and pieces of things. So I'm fascinated by that, by that. What's in the interstices? What do we not know? And part of the reason I was such a crazy person about researching this book, I mean, I really, every detail, you know, which is part of why it took me so long to write the book. If the characters are sitting, eating a meal, what are the utensils on the table? What's the view out the window? What can they see through that wavering glass? Because they couldn't make the same kind of panes of glass we have now. You know, every detail was so important to me. And part of why I was so insane about the research was that to me it was part of a larger point. I wanted, as much as I could get it, I wanted everything in the book to be accurate, because I feel like it's fiction. Esther Velasquez is not based on an actual person. But if someone said to me, well, okay, but women like this didn't exist, my response really is, how do we know? They could have. So if you think about, you know, people say, well, okay, we only have a few extant, you know, women's writing from that time period, and you had to be pretty much wealthy and childless. We have, Anne of Conway, Elizabeth Bohemia, you had to be royalty. But I feel like, how do we know other people weren't doing it? Just because something was against the rules doesn't mean people weren't doing it. I mean, when history puts a foot on people's necks, they break rules. Right? Yeah. It doesn't mean they're bad people. It just means that's what people do. My family were law-abiding citizens till the war, and then they bribed, stole, you know, did everything they had to get through it, and then they were law-abiding citizens again. So I know that on a visceral level, people do what the grass does. They try to grow up through pavement. They try to break through. Most don't succeed, but some do. So for anybody of this time period who wasn't supposed to be able to write or read or speak, to actually do it, they had to break rules, and they probably had to do it under a man's name. So if they did it successfully, nobody knew.
Right.
So if they were there, how do we know? So I feel like I wanted everything in the book to be plausible because I think that Esther Velasquez could have existed. Someone could have done something like that.
Great. Thank you. I'd love to open up to any questions that you might have for Rachel. And if you don't, I have more.
So I love the book.
Thank you.
And one of the questions I have is, you know, sometimes I find that the blurbs give away too much. So I walked into this book completely cold. So I didn't even know it was about women. But it was the title of the book that caught my attention. Ink, weight, come on, right? So I start reading this, and in my head, I'm thinking it's a guy because of the time frame. Of course it's a guy. But it sounds feminine. So it's that reveal that happened was beautiful. And that's one of the questions I have is, how much is too much for a reader to know before we open up a book?
Oh, that's a fascinating question.
That's a really interesting question.
And I love, so you didn't read any of the blurbs. That's so, and it was, so if we had half an hour, I would want to like go through and be like, oh, so which parts felt feminine and which, yeah, I mean, I never know. I mean, that's sort of the question for the marketing people. But, of course, when you're starting writing the book, you have to assume that people are going through like a little flashlight that lights up one sentence at a time and the rest is dark and they can't see anything else. And I do like that feeling of mystery. I love that you assumed it was a guy in the beginning. I want that mystery of, like, what is this? It's a text. We have no idea what it is. What's the story behind it? Maybe it's bigger than we have any idea.
Question. So I knew going into it what to expect, a bad turn of phrase this week. I'd love to know a little more about the research in this day and age of sitting in front of a computer and finding out so much. Did you have to run hither and yon and deal with books, and how did you proceed?
Yes. The little secret here is, you know, I wrote this book, half of it set in the 17th century, and I couldn't have written it without the internet. I had young kids, and it was very hard for me. I got out to rare manuscripts rooms. That's why the Patricias are in the book, because I've been intimidated by many rare manuscript room librarians, and I love them. But I was able to take a research trip to London, but, you know, the moving pieces I had to arrange for childcare to get there for 6 days, you know, so it was, but I have shelves full of books. It's amazing. There are these books full of details of life from 17th century London. You want to know how much a loaf of bread cost? You know, it's right there. This Liza Picard writes these books. They're incredible. I have books of fashion from the time, you know, and I just kept going. And somebody asked me at one point, how long did you research the book before you started writing? I can't even answer that question, because to me, that's like saying, so to swim a mile, you would do all the breathing first and then all the swimming. You know, it was, you know, back and forth. So I would research. So I would be reading, you know, how much does a loaf of bread cost? And then I would find out that the flour wasn't well sifted if you were poor and the inexpensive loaves. And there were sometimes stones. So there's a moment in the book where Rivka breaks a tooth on a stone in a loaf of bread. You know, it was like totally back and forth with the research. And it's amazing what you can find online. I never made it to Amsterdam, but the archives of the Bibliotheca Etzraim are online, and you can read Spinoza's Banishment, you know, the fire and brimstone thing they wrote against him. So it's all there.
Great. Thank you. I'm sorry. Did you have one more question?
I had a question about the creative process, and that is, you said you wrote this passage first. At the time, how much of the story was in your mind? Did you have an idea about the character, about the fact that it took place in two centuries, et cetera?
I had no idea. I had no idea. I'd read A.S. Byatt's Possession, and I loved that idea of the structure going back and forth, contemporary versus the historical period. So I thought I wanted to try to do something like that, but it's all a leap of faith. I have no idea where I'm going when I start writing.
Thank you so much. So our second writer today is Brendan Matthews, speaking about his breathtaking debut novel, The World of Tomorrow. It's June 1939. Francis Dempsey and his shell-shocked brother, Michael, are on an ocean liner from Ireland, headed for their brother Martin's home in New York City, having stolen a small fortune from the IRA. During the week that follows, their lives collide spectacularly with big band jazz musicians, a talented but fragile heiress, a Jewish street photographer facing a return to Nazi-occupied Prague, a vengeful mobster, and the ghosts of their own family's revolutionary past. But when Tom Cronin, a one-time assassin forced into one last job, tracks the brothers down, their lives begin to fracture. Francis must capitulate to blackmail or have his family suffer fatal consequences. Michael, wandering alone, turns to the heartsick artist, Lily Block, to recover his lost memory. And Francis and his wife, Rosemary, try to salvage a marriage, a wedding, and ultimately the lives of the other Dempseys. From the smoky jazz joints of Harlem to the Plaza Hotel, from the garrets of artists in the Bowery to the shadowy warehouses of mobsters in Hell's Kitchen, Brendan Matthews brings pre-war New York to vivid, pulsing life, while the sweeping and intricate storytelling of this remarkable novel reveals an America that blithely hoped it could avoid another catastrophic war by focusing instead on the promise of the World's Fair, a peaceful, prosperous world of tomorrow. Anne Beattie describes the world of tomorrow as a panoramic tour de force, and the novel has received an avalanche, I don't think that's an understatement of praise, an overstatement of praise. Yeah, no, there's a lot of praise out for this book out there. Starred reviews in all four trade journals. It's been named a must-read for fall by Entertainment Weekly, the Seattle Times, O Magazine, NPR, the Wall Street Journal, and Book Page, which describes it as a sweeping, impressive accomplishment. Matthews has written an insightful immigrant epic, not to mention a first-class literary thriller. The World of Tomorrow is a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice, and Sam Sachs in the Wall Street Journal describes it as entertaining, outsized, reveling in bold twists, fantastic coincidences. Matthews' big expressive debut inhabits a world that's neither of the past nor the future, but wholly of the imagination. So let's turn to the passage you chose. Can you talk, you want to read that out loud?
Sure.
Yeah, great, thanks.
I hope the passage lives up to that avalanche of praise that preceded it.
There was a lot of praise. I kept finding it. It was everywhere.
She ran her fingers through his hair, jet black like Evie's. She did love him, and that should be enough to make the rest of this bearable. The apartment and Mrs. Fischetti, the long nighttime hours when the girls were asleep and Martin was in the city, all that time when it was just her and her thoughts and no one to talk to. She hadn't counted on this being such a lonely life. She had imagined that she would be part of Martin's world, a world of music and cocktails and men in sharp suits and women in dresses you'd see in magazines. They'd had that life, both of them, but only for a few months. She still kept the memories boxed up. She took them out and looked them over during the long nights, but lately it didn't cheer her to think of the life they had lived in the not so long ago. Increasingly, she felt cheated by the life she lived in the here and now, a life of rent, utility bills, groceries, a tab at the butcher shop, a husband who would quit a good job. I know what you're angling for with all this lovey talk. Can a man tell his wife how he feels? Of course he can. He just shouldn't expect anything in return. And what am I expecting? Something that could lead to another crib in the girls' room. I'm not thinking about babies, not one bit. And that's your problem. You never think about babies until it's too late.
So I'd love you to talk a little bit about this scene with respect to how perspective and different voices and that shifting point of view really works in this novel.
Sure. So this is a scene that takes place, the book takes place over the course of 1 week. Starts on a Saturday, ends on a Saturday, and this is Tuesday night. And Martin Dempsey, who's, up until a few days before this, played in a big band in New York City, popular big band, is talking to his wife, Rosemary. And he's quit that job in the hope of starting a band that's going to be more to his tastes. And when I started the book, Martin and his brothers Francis and Michael, who were the two who sort of fled Ireland, were really at the center of the book. I'm one of four brothers myself. My father is one of five brothers. There are a lot of Irish brothers in my family. But as I started working on the book, what kept me interested were these other voices that kept popping up and suggesting themselves. And one of the most insistent, one of the first to really elbow her way into the book, was Rosemary, who's Martin's wife. And as I thought about the role that she would play, I thought about my own family. My father's side was this family full of brothers. There was a 60-year gap in the family where no women were born. It was just generation of boys. And so the story the family often tells itself is that, oh, well, it's a family full of boys, except there were all these women who married into the family, who had the guts to marry into the Matthews family. And they're the ones that have always, generation after generation, kept the family together. They're there. They're the rock, really. And they're also fun, and they're smart, and they're witty. And I wanted that in the book. And so Rosemary, I think, was the one who reminded me of all of my aunts who came into our family and saved it from being this monkish colony of unlovable Matthews. And so here I was one of the first places where I was just the two of them together. So much of the book, there's a lot happening. And this was the first time that the kind of stage is cleared and just the kids are asleep and Martin and Rosemary have a chance to talk to each other. And he leads this outsized life. You know, he's been playing in this band. His brother is on the run from the IRA. His other brother, Michael, is through the book conversing with a ghost of William Butler Yeats. And here's Rosemary, and she's outside of that, and she's feeling cheated. And I wanted the book not only, I didn't want her to be the long-suffering wife. I wanted Rosemary in this book to really come to the fore and push for what she wanted.
And the other thing that's happening in this passage that I love is, and I'm sure you all got a sense of this, is that the prose is so dynamic and so alive, and the dialogue is so, you just feel like you're right there. Is dialogue something that you probably don't have to work for it too much? Speaking from a writer who has to work at dialogue.
I have to work to cut it down, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think so this book was written over the course of about 7.5 years, and it was written in fits and starts, and sometimes it would be weeks or more before I was really back in a scene and I would come back to it. And I felt like when I was starting, I could always do dialogue. And even when I was writing the book, I would often, every morning I'd take my dog for a walk, and I would take my phone out, and while I was walking the dog, and I would have the voice memos thing on, and I would do, if I had an idea for something I didn't have time to write, I would just recite it into the phone, and then I would type it up or write it up later. And I would try to do different, there's a lot of accents in the book, so I try to do different voices. It's terrible. I hope no one ever, a lot of them have been deleted. The dog would look at me in a weird way because he would hear these voices. So I would start with these voices, and then I could write dialogue, but sometimes too much. And the trick for me was figuring out what's the useful dialogue. In the last edit of the book, when I really thought it was done, I mean, the book is, it's long, but I think it reads quick, not to scare anyone off. The book, the final version was about 580 manuscript pages. Well, what I thought was the final version was actually over six. It was like 650 pages. And my editor came to me and had this sort of moment where he said, you know, we've been talking about restraint at different points, which is hard with a book this long. And most of the places where he was counseling restraint were around conversations. And I would look through, and he's very good on the level of the line and also on the structural stuff, but there were some passages where there was just a line that ran along a 3 or 4 page conversation, and it just said, compress. And so trying to figure out what doesn't need to be said, I think for me, is more of an issue than trying to figure out what to say.
What needs to be in there.
Yeah.
So in this passage, as throughout the book, and I mentioned this to you in an email, the writing is just so alive on the page. Like, you just feel like you are right in this world, and it's a whole world. Like, it's not this, you know, this is a far-reaching and ambitious novel, and you're getting into all of the crannies and the corners of pre-war New York and into the, you know, these kind of, the intimate lives of these family, the intimate spaces in this family. But it also kind of moves, as it does here in this passage moves from those really minute, vivid, intimate moments to that long throw of time. Does that resonate with you? That long throw of time of a life. I mean, and that's how Rosemary is talking about, you know, her kind of, you know, you've encapsulated in this passage, you know, not just the intimacy and some of the tensions in their relationship, mm-hmm. but also her relationship to her life.
Yeah, I think because the book is set over the course of a week, I had to really think about what can actually happen in the course of a week. You know, how much does any of us, even in a really important, a really consequential week, how much do we change? And so I had to, in some ways, that helped give me a boundary to work within and to think about what could really happen. But it is an important week for them, and so I wanted there to be a sense of this being, of Rosemary carrying a lot of baggage into this week, but also knowing that there were things ahead that she wanted. And in the novel, too, the week helped me from getting overwhelmed by all of the history and the research, because it's June 1939, the World's Fair is going on. The war is going to start in a couple of months. No one knows that for sure, but a lot of them suspect it. There's all these big kind of headline events that are happening. But what's most important for the characters here is Martin quit his job, and Rosemary's sister is going to call off her wedding, which is supposed to happen in another day, and these brothers have shown up, and what are we going to do about them? And one of the brothers is injured, and how are we going to find a doctor? And so while there's all these big things happening, the kind of gears of history turning, I always try to bring it back to those intimate moments. Like, for me, it only worked as a book if you cared about the characters. And Rosemary and Martin only matter if you actually believe they're in love with each other, but also can see why she's at her wit's end. And so it was always trying to get to those things, because it was easy to gesture at the big moments and think about, like, you know, look what's happening in New York right now, and look at this grand moment. And those are easy to write about. But that's for history books. That's the stuff that historians do. Like, I wanted to get to the level of the character and let them walk around in this particular week with these particular people and let the sparks fly.
So I have one more question before we're going to open this up. But there's a review of this novel on NPR that I adore, and I'm just going to read one short passage from it. "The World of Tomorrow is that rarest of historical novels, a book that catches a moment in a jar, holds it aloft, and displays it for what it really is. Somebody else's day before tomorrow, the instant right before the future comes. Matthew's entire novel takes place over the course of 1 week in June of that year, culminating at the World's Fair itself in a fast-paced finale worthy of a Scorsese long take." I love that.
But film agents take note. Worthy
so
of a Scorsese long take.
So I'm not going to ask you, I don't want you to talk about the ending per se, mm-hmm. but I'd like to know, there's a kind of sense of hurtling drive throughout this book. Like you said, it's a long book. It reads very fast. And I felt like I was hurtling toward that, you know, an ending without knowing what that ending was. Mm-hmm. Did you know where you were writing toward?
Toward
the end. Did you know?
At some point, I said it took seven and a half years. Probably 6 years in, I knew how it was going to end.
6 years.
It took a long time. And for a while, I thought, I kept writing towards the ending, and it felt like the horizon kept receding. And I once had this, you know, what I thought was a brilliant idea for how it was going to end. There's one character in the novel who I had said to my wife, "Oh, I finally figured it out. This character is going to die at the end of the book. Has to. It's the only way this book makes sense narratively." And she looked at me and she said, I won't say the name because I don't give anything away. "If that character dies, I'll leave you." So this is where I could relate to Martin and Rosemary very close
there.
To here. And so then I scuttled that and had to work towards a different ending. But actually, the thing that actually got me towards the ending was there was at some point in the edit process, my editor looked at it and he said, there's a lot of characters, and there was one character who appeared early and appeared late. And she was somebody who mattered deeply to me, but I had her in the moments that she was in, they seemed important. And my editor said, "I think we need to see her again. Like, we need to know over the course of these days, like, where is she on?" He said, "I don't know where, but she's got to appear somewhere else in the book. And I don't know what has to happen to her, but there's got to be something else." Mm-hmm. And when he first said it, I kind of groaned because I knew he was right, but I knew it was going to take a lot of work because I didn't know where she was. And it forced me to dig in and think about where that was, what was going on. And as soon as I wrote that chapter, I knew how the book was going to end.
That's great. I think questions can be a driving force in the creation of a novel, that sometimes when we sit in that question, that can lead to the revelation that we need. So I'd love to open up to questions from you for the next 4 or 5 minutes.
Why this time and place? What made you want to write about this setting?
Well, a couple of things. One, so I mentioned this family of boys and men I'm from. My grandfather, Peter Matthews, was an Irish immigrant to the U.S. He came over in 1929 to be an arranger in a big band. That was his dream. And so one of the characters, Martin, is very loosely based on him. And I figured 10 years gave him enough time to have arrived and gotten his feet and tasted success and then maybe plateaued. But that put me in the 30s, and what the reason 1939 became the time and why June, partly was because we had the World's Fair opened in April, and it was this moment of great optimism. It was a really rosy vision of what the future was probably going to look like. And then the war starts in September. And June is right between these moments of optimism and catastrophe. And for so many of the characters, exist for different reasons in their own personal lives between great hope for the future and the near certitude that it's all going to blow up. And so that moment really seemed to be a ripe one to set the book during.
You mentioned the dog walks and the Voice Memos app. I wondered if you had any other strategies you used for fitting writing into the sort of small spaces if you didn't have
I mean, pretty much the entire first draft was handwritten. I just found at some point I just don't compose well on the laptop. I'm also really distractible, and I can't check my email on a piece of paper. So I'd learned that it was handy for me just to have a pen and to go. I'm also more likely to take chances, and I'll draw diagrams, and I can cross things out. And if I cross it out, I can still see it later on, which Microsoft Word doesn't allow you to do. I guess there's ways you can do that, but it just seemed to be too tricky after a while. And that's, you know, the notebooks I have for this, sometimes I'm writing in the pages, and then there's a lot of loose sheets of typing paper that are in there. There's receipts that I've written on the back of. There's like old menus if I'm waiting for my kids to finish soccer practice, and there's an idea, and I learned not to trust my memory, that if I think I'm going to remember something in the morning, I'm not. Or an hour from now, or when I sit down to write it, I think it's going to be there. I kind of learned that if I didn't put it down to paper, then it was gone. So there's a lot of scrap paper that went into this. It made it hard to, once I would finally type everything up, it would kind of be hard to find and collate everything. But that also was useful, having a handwritten version and then starting to type it into the laptop. That was the first edit a lot of times because I could clean up the language a little bit, but I would be sort of maniacally paranoid because I only had this handwritten version. And so I'd carry it with me everywhere, I think, people in town. I became one of those characters, I think, who was always seen, like, with a handcuff around him and around the bag. And I actually had a safe deposit box at the local bank where I would put the stack of pages before I could transcribe it. So they think I was either, like, running a drug operation. Because it's a small local bank. I'd go in there all the time, like, just need to see my safe deposit box. And I'd go in there, and they'd put you in the special room. I'd crank open the box. I'd drop in these pages. I'd shut it, and I'd hand it back, like, okay, all done. And they're like, what are you doing? So... hopefully they know now what I was doing. They're not still following me.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So our third and final writer today is award-winning author Paul Yoon, who will be discussing his transcendent collection of short stories, The Mountain. In The Mountain, Yoon displays his subtle, ethereal, and strikingly observant style with 6 thematically linked stories taking place across several continents and time periods, and populated with characters who are connected by their traumatic pasts, migrant lives, and quests for solace in their futures. Though they exist in their own distinct worlds, from a sanatorium in the Hudson Valley to an inn in the Russian Far East, they are united by the struggle to reconcile their traumatic pasts in the wake of violence, big and small, spiritual and corporeal. A morphine-addicted nurse wanders through the decimated French countryside in search of purpose. A dissatisfied wife sporadically takes a train across Spain with a much younger man in the wake of a building explosion. A lost young woman emigrates from Korea to Shanghai, where she works in a camera sweatshop, trying to outrun the ghosts of her past. Hailed by New York Magazine as a quotidian surreal craftmaster, and a radiant star in the current literary firmament by the Dallas Morning News, Yoon realizes his worlds with precise, gorgeous prose. Though each story is distinct from the others, his restrained voice and perceptive observations about violence to the body, the landscape, and ultimately the soul weave throughout these stories. And The Mountain is a spellbinding read, and it's actually it's one of the greatest collections, frankly, that I have ever read. The Mountain receives starred reviews in Kirkus, Publishers Weekly, and Library Journal, which describes Paul as a literary alchemist, transforming tragedy into beauty with deft reminders of our universal connection. The collection has been widely praised by the LA Times, GQ, and many other publications. The Boston Globe praises The Mountain as a genuine work of art, a shadowland of survivors that is tough and elegant and true. BookPage calls the collection radiant. Yoon uses precise, measured prose to create atmospheric narratives that lack neat resolutions. The Mountain's overall mood is one of wistfulness, a feeling that stays with the reader after the final page has been turned. Please welcome Paul Yoon. So let's turn to the passage you chose. Could you read that aloud for us?
Yeah, absolutely. Can everyone hear me all right? Thank you, Don. And Rachel, Brendan, thank you so much. Snowdrift has accumulated outside the hospital. New slopes have formed on the lawn. From the window, Mikhail watches an old woman take a tin tray and slide down the shallow hill, her legs in the air. She tumbles and rolls. Her gray hair unravels in the snow. He tries to place her among all the people who work here, but she's too far and hidden by the collar of her coat. She lies there looking up, and Mikhail follows her eyes. He sees nothing, only the flat evenness of 1,000 clouds. It is winter, January. He has watched the year pass, learning how to walk again. 3 months, unaware of snow, unaware of where he is on this hill overlooking Calais and the sea. He wheeled himself out one day and stopped at the main doors, stunned by the height and the view. Construction cranes, the harbor, ships and ferries sailing to and from England. He turned back in, not yet used to pushing himself with one hand. He has stayed away from the front doors since then. He keeps the long ward, the curtains of privacy, the old bareness, the occasional sound of the old woman passing the window sledding.
So can you tell us a little bit about how this passage fits into the story, Still a Fire, that it's from, and also how it reflects the, the arc of the collection as a whole? I know that's a tall order.
I'll start with the first question.
Okay.
It's a baby order.
Yeah.
This is an excerpt. It's sort of midway through the story. The story is set in the years following the Second World War in sort of northern France. And what has happened here is that Mikhail has been injured terribly in an accident in sort of the end of part one. And so this starts, much time has passed, so this starts with him at the hospital recovering. The purpose of this passage for me was, if you were to think of the first part as something that was very sort of, it had a lot of movement in it. It was sort of moving toward a specific violent event. And the last scene had a lot of sort of action and choreography. I wanted to sort of begin part two in a way that was the polar opposite of that. That was very still. It was very quiet. And so part of this was just kind of slowing things down. The first sentence, Snowdrift has accumulated outside the hospital. It's a very still sentence. It's a sentence that's just kind of like, time has passed. And so part of it was just sort of, it was a great relief, actually, for me to slow down a bit, actually. And also make sure that the reader knows that time has passed, right? So if the first section ends, or if the first part ends, and it's, spring or something, then we need to figure out how to signify to the reader that it's now winter. I chose something, simple like weather to begin there.
And there is throughout this collection, there's a kind of still simplicity to the sentence structure and to the language, but I often had the sense that even though there is that simplicity, it's almost like a line break in a poem that can sometimes send you, like, hurtling, you know, into the next space, you know, into the, you know, into another psyche, into another world, into another landscape, both literal and also metaphoric or psychological or emotional. And was that, is that something that you're cognizant of in your writing process? Does that make sense, the question?
I mean, I think for me, it's just a question of, you know, how deeply embedded are we in a point of view, right? In the point of view of a character, and sort of how are we translating that via sort of the observations about, you know, not only sort of the world, the external world, but also just kind of the world of what's going on in their mind. And so I think the trick for me was sort of navigating those two, but also dealing with characters who are, most of these characters are sort of, you know, they're coping with some kind of deep trauma in some way that may not be obvious. And so how do you present that through prose,
right,
essentially?
Through prose, yeah, and also, yeah, the white space. So also the, yeah, dislocation between, you know, between, you know, passages or between events.
Yeah, and just kind of, I mean, partly I think it's also, I am a fan of sort of, you know, minimalism.
Right.
So part of that is just sort of, you know, it's my natural mode of,
right,
writing.
Right.
And so, but I do remember, you know, working on this book and trying to find that balance between how do I evoke, you know, trauma without explicitly stating trauma, and yet being able to fully create a world that was vivid and, you know, rich and not too restrained and not too spare. And to kind of like find that balance.
Well, and sometimes, right, yeah, in those ellipses, you know, in those gaps, what's not being said is as explosive as actually what's emotionally explosive as what's on the page.
Yeah, and just letting sort of images breathe just a little bit,
yeah,
right? To sort of let a woman sledding downhill just kind of pause on that for a little bit and just kind of let it exist.
Yeah.
In the fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did research inspire this, you know, your, or how, and how did that process of research inspire the collection, and also to what, because it never feels, I feel like I'm so in the world, but it never feels like the research is in any way impeding the, you know, the kind of emotional arc or the storyline arc.
Yeah, I mean, but the complicated thing about this book, and maybe this sort of goes to your first question, was, you know, I have this book that's set all across the world, and so it starts in early 20th century upstate New York, before the First World War, and then it goes east across the world. At the same time, it goes forward in time to sort of an alternate near future. So research was overwhelming because I had New York, Europe, Russian Far East, East Asia, and so I sort of, for me, I think I did kind of something like a cousin to what Rachel was doing, which is, you know, I would work on something, and if I hit some kind of roadblock, I would go and research it, which I think is what you were doing, Rachel, and then kind of push on. The tricky thing for this book, and maybe just for me and my own confidence, was that sometimes I would, you know, be uncertain about something, and then I would, you know, research it, and it wasn't entirely, like, in sync with my vision of the narrative or the story, and so I sort of had to ask myself, do I, like, give myself permission to just kind of fake it right now, like, in draft work mode, and kind of ignore that this is really not accurate, and just push on to hopefully discover the story. And then, so I did that. I gave myself that kind of permission. And then, of course, when I was done with sort of an arc that I felt good about, I could go back and make sure that I wasn't doing anything that was sort of grossly, you know, offensive to the history in some way, right?
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So many of the protagonists in these stories suffer the consequences of wars that have been fought by previous generations. And while the stories are each discrete and self-contained, they also are thematically linked. And in these stories, you're working into hard questions about displacement mm-hmm. and the universality of the migrant experience and how our apparently disparate lives are also undergirded by these kind of strong bonds and sense of connection. So there's a redemptive, you know, sense and a sense of kind of trying to reckon with those pasts that runs throughout this this book.
Yeah, I mean, just sort of movement is something that I've just kind of always been interested in, whether it's, you know, migration, immigration, and sort of, you know, displacement, diaspora. And, I mean, the sort of the quick three-part answer to this is, you know, A, it's in the news.
Right.
It's very much in the news, so it's very much a part of my life in that kind of global way, right? Two, it's there's a kind of personal history, right? So, you know, my father fled North Korea during, you know, the Korean War and started another life in South Korea. So there's that sort of, you know, you're born in that kind of, you know, you're born as a migrant, that sort of thing, your history as a migrant. And also, I was coming at this book from sort of constantly moving around. My wife and I, my wife's also a fiction writer, and so we would, you know, ever since we met, we would always be in one place for, you know, just 1 or 2 years because of, you know, day jobs, and then we'd sort of pack up and go somewhere else. And so when I was given the opportunity to write this book, it was the first time that we were sort of going to be in a place for a long time. And so, and yet I still sort of had the kind of the contrails of kind of being on the go.
Right.
And so I was just thinking a lot about that, and just on a personal level, but also on a global level too.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'd love you to, I just have one more question.
Yeah.
In a recent interview in the Boston Globe, you talk about a William Maxwell book you were reading. I think it was So Long, See You Tomorrow,
yeah, So Long,
right?
See You Tomorrow, yeah.
And how that book, which I also love, is structured like a collage.
Yeah.
Again, we were talking before about there's air and there's white space mm-hmm. and there's like a fractured kind of way of a story unfolding. And, you know, that gives a narrative a sense of drive and mystery, mm-hmm. you know, where there's pieces and secrets and kind of dimensions of past and memory that are falling into place.
Yeah.
So how is that kind of fractured process? Is that just the way, do you know what I mean, of kind of coming, of pieces falling into place, like interlocking like a puzzle? Is that something that drives you as a writer?
Yeah, absolutely. Just briefly, the novel, William Maxwell's So Long, See You Tomorrow, is set in 1920s Illinois. I don't know if you're aware of it, but it was inspired in part by a sculpture by the Italian artist Giacometti. I don't remember the title of the sculpture, but it's a house, and it's sort of, it's just all like post beam, like it's just all air, right? And then there's kind of a mysterious person in a corner, and then there's like sort of a floating window in another corner. And so this sculpture sort of inspired Maxwell to write this book that's very much, you know, just sort of, it's only 100 pages, I think, right? So it's just this kind of, the white space, the emptiness is just as important as what's on the page. And so I think the books that I read sort of growing up were sort of in that vein, and so I was inspired by that. I think just on artistically, I find that interesting because it's sort of an engagement with the reader, mm-hmm. right? So it's like, you know, you take a step forward, then the reader takes a step forward. And where can we sort of find that middle ground where we meet, essentially, right? And so so I'm always sort of interested in that.
Great,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So we have time for a few questions before we wrap up. Are there any questions? Yes.
In terms of just like the book itself, well, I mean, just basically creating the stories, they were hard. I think it's a question of, for me, like the steps forward were, again, creating a world point of view that had to do with characters dealing with trauma, right? And so how much of that world am I going to paint, and how much of that can I sort of entrust the reader to sort of fill in for themselves? A lot of the stories, a lot of the sort of events and the action, they're not explicitly stated in the book or in the stories themselves, and so I was also sort of relying on the reader to hopefully kind of make a leap and sort of imagine like the bridge between specific events, things like that. Does that answer your question? Okay, that was kind of a tricky question, so I just want to make sure, yeah.
In your own process, you know, you say you really like minimalism. In your own process, do you tend to write larger and then cut back?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, process-wise, we're all just sort of stumbling, right? And so we're just, like, trying to get everything down. And so, you know, this is the longest story in the collection, and it's 60 pages. But, you know, the original drafts were, you know, bordering on 200. And so, yeah, but it's sort of, you know, I'm maximalist in terms of I want to know the world. You know, I want to get to know everything. I want to know, you know, this character's favorite color, all of that stuff, right? Who their first, you know, heartbreak was, all that. It's important to me to sort of build characters in that way, and also the physical landscape. And so then it's a question, I think Brendan was saying about, like, you know, paring down the dialogue, right? And I think for me it's a question of how do you pare down, like, the world and the characters, like, enough to get a sense of a fuller picture. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So during your, I guess, writing process, did you ever find that you got so caught up in the story that you thought that you or the reader wouldn't like where it ended up, but you still went with it because it was so thrilling for you?
Wow, I don't think anyone's ever asked me that question. It's a really great question. You know, I think, honestly, I don't think I've felt that. I'll answer that kind of in a sideways way, which is I'm never confident in any sort of scene or event or action that's progressing through the story while I'm drafting, right? So I think everyone's going to hate everything. So I think the trick is actually to sort of try not to think about the reader and just hope that, you know, in the kind of fumbling and the bumbling and the rolling along, you'll sort of find something that's worth it. And then, you know, the beauty of the craft and the writing process is that, you know, it's not locked once you finish, right? You have drafts and drafts and revisions to go through. So I think it's a question of, you know, if you stumble the first time, you can always, you know, get up again and change it too.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you all so much for being here. And our authors are going to be signing books outside, and books are available for sale from Newtonville Books. And thank you for coming.